It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. Criminal courts around the country are returning to in-person trials following the pandemic, and they are facing case backlogs. Allegheny Court of Common Pleas resumed in late April after almost a year of virtual proceedings. David Schrager is the managing partner of Schrager Defense Attorneys serving Western Pennsylvania. David, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, David, is Allegheny County experiencing a backlog of cases due to COVID-19?
Yes and no. During this time period, we have had to negotiate two non-negotiables. That means the courts had to, one, keep people safe. We can't let people get sicker and die. And then we also have the obligation to protect people's civil liberties. So the courts did the best that they could to preserve people's civil liberties while at the same time keeping lawyers, judges, support staff, and prisoners safe. The courthouse and the jails were hotspots. So yes, we do have cases that are scheduled a little further in the future than would be normal, but they also did a very good job of getting rid of the cases that we could get rid of in a safe way, an expeditious way.
So you just mentioned that there were some trials that had to go forward. What kind of cases were those?
Well, if someone was in jail for a long period of time, they have the right to be heard. We can't just keep people in the jail indefinitely. So some of those trials were going forward, sometimes just based on the severity of the issues or also the wishes of the defendant. But most were delayed, if possible, because most of the time we could delay those trials without doing any harm to anyone.
What was the reasoning for some people who decided to put off the trials until it could be in person?
At one point in time, some of the people had we could have a trial, but it would have been virtual over Zoom or Microsoft Teams. And those were bench trials where a judge was making that decision. And some of our defendants that were in our firm preferred to wait to have their trial in person because they felt that was the decision that they wanted to make. Some of the people made the decision just to get it done.
You know, now that you've worked in a virtual trial landscape and you've worked in an in-person trial landscape, what are some of the kind of tangible things that happen in an in-person trial that can be really valuable when working on a case?
It's my belief that, and we've all heard that old adage that I think what they say, like 90% of communication is nonverbal. If it was a situation where I had to ascertain someone's credibility, where I had to make really important judgments about really important matters, about who's telling the truth, about what transpired, I would really prefer to be in person hearing that person tell their tale, to listen to their story in person. And I believe that's the best way to be able to receive all the information, to be able to make that decision.
What kind of cases were the courts able to put off, to push to the side and say, we can hold off on this for now?
Cases that, while still important, the defendant, maybe were less charges, misdemeanor charges, and the defendant was not incarcerated. So, for example, perhaps someone had a shoplifting case. It's an important matter. It has to be addressed by the courts. That's nothing to disregard. But at the same time, we are able to say, okay, this shoplifting case, which is scheduled for now, you're going to come back here in 6 months and we're going to deal with it then. And that's okay. The person's not a danger to the community. No, nothing bad is happening. And we're going to address the case. It's not going away, but we're just going to delay it in order to preserve human life. That's a very, I think, an important and a good and valid exchange.
Now, if you're one of those people who had a misdemeanor charge and the courts are back open, are you just kind of waiting until you hear from someone that, you know, now finally your time is up, you're going to appear before a judge?
Most of the people now have what we call a date certain. They know when their case is going to be called and they're able to appropriately prepare for that with their attorney. At one point in time during the height of Corona, we would have new dates, but I knew that those would probably be moved again. And during the height of Corona, a lot of times I had to say what lawyers don't like to say to their clients, which is, I don't know. Because none of us knew, you know, how long is this going to last? Where is it going to end? When is there going to be a vaccine? None of us knew. And we did the best that we could to keep everything moving forward and keep the clients informed. But it was difficult when there was no answers to be found. But now it seems like things are more or less cemented.
So now that we've reached this point where people are getting vaccinated, in-person proceedings are happening again, from your perspective and conversations that you've had from people in the courts, from judges, clerks, other lawyers, what kind of work has to be done right now to address the backlog that people might be seeing?
All the lawyers are executing the cases as quickly as they possible without compromising the rights of our clients. That's not back to those non-negotiables. We want to get cases moving, but we can't do it at the expense of someone's civil liberties. That's just not acceptable. So everyone is doing things as quickly as they can while not, like I say, compromising on quality. We have a good schedule moving forward, and we are going to catch up. Is there a little bit of a backlog? Absolutely. And we were already working pretty close to full capacity as it was, meaning the court system was, working pretty quickly around here and had a lot of cases to begin with. But everyone is doing everything that they can to chip away at that, and we will get through the backlog.
David Schrager is a criminal defense attorney serving Western Pennsylvania. David, thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you so much. My pleasure. Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last Monday and Tuesday, Allegheny County saw an additional 125 COVID-19 cases. That's much lower than the peak of the virus months ago, but it is a significant increase from just a month ago when the county was seeing 10 to 20 daily cases. With the rise of transmission in the Delta variant of COVID-19, greater attention is being paid for those not yet vaccinated. So how are doctors persuading people to get the jab? Dr. Maya Raghavan is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. She's also co-research lead of the Pittsburgh Community Vaccine Collaborative, which is working with organizations to promote vaccinations in hard-to-reach communities. Thanks for taking the time.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Right now, who is the group that you are finding is the most reluctant to be vaccinated?
There's large groups of young people who still haven't been vaccinated. There's groups that have, issues in terms of getting access to vaccines. There's definitely different groups of individuals who are still kind of thinking through the process and who have lots of questions that we're all trying to help support them in making that decision. Mm.
So how are you targeting information to the unvaccinated, whether it's young adults or someone else?
As the pandemic is continuing and the vaccine rollout is continuing, we're very much focused on sort of a multi-level, multi-factor strategy to support people getting vaccinated. And so that's having, community-based clinics, school-based clinics, and then also having the vaccine available at your doctor's office or another place that you really trust. And so that's kind of what we're working on now. And throughout this whole process, we've been very much focused on vaccine trustworthiness. We know that particularly for communities of color, that there are many well-justified reasons they may not sort of trust medical professionals, trust researchers. And so we're really trying to build up the vaccine and medical professionals and researchers as trustworthy and kind of shifting that responsibility to sort of medical professionals and researchers.
The information has been out there and it's been reinforced. Experts, including yourself, they're on and in the media doing interviews such as this, trying to explain the importance of vaccination. And yet the vaccinations have slowed to a trickle. I mean, really, other than going door to door, what can you do to convince people?
I mean, I think those one-on-one conversations are really, really important. And so part of it is, I still think that thinking about where people want to get vaccinated is really important. And so I'm a pediatrician, so I'll speak from the vantage point of vaccinating young people. Pediatricians and pediatric healthcare providers are very used to having conversations about vaccines. I mean, vaccinations are a critical part of well child care. And oftentimes, you know, pediatricians can be very trusted for families. And so I think it's really important to have the vaccines available at pediatric offices and for pediatric healthcare providers to have the time and comfort to talk about the COVID-19 vaccine with families, both with the young people, but also with their parents. I also recognize that for some families, the pediatric office may not be the trusted vaccine source in their life. And so I think it's also really important to continue having vaccine availability at schools, at community sites, at pharmacies. You know, I really think that having it in multiple places is important. But I do agree that I think those one-on-one conversations are critical and can happen in different ways, but definitely at the doctor's office is one of them. Mm-hmm.
Do you get frustrated trying to convince people who are believing and citing false information about the vaccines compared to those who might just say to you, "We don't know enough about the long-term effects of the vaccines"?
No, I don't think frustrated is the right word at all, because I really, so again, kind of speaking from the vantage point of parents, right, thinking about their kids' vaccines, or even like an adult thinking about their own health choices, you know, it's really hard to navigate health information. All parents want is for their kids to be healthy and well, and it's I really feel for parents who are navigating all these, you know, difficult health decisions that they're trying to make. And I recognize that many of them are doing what they think is best for their children or for themselves. And so I don't get frustrated. I definitely, though, want to spend that time learning why. Like, I want to know their why. You know, what is it about the COVID vaccine that is scary to them, that's frustrating to them, that's confusing to them, that makes them anxious? And then kind of, you know, easing into really trying to educate and inform and make sure that they have the knowledge that they need to make a decision.
Mm-hmm. So early on, when the vaccine was available and the people who definitely wanted, there were challenges getting vaccinated and wait times. And if you try to hop on and sign up, it would often be filled up in a matter of minutes. Now, with the vaccinations really, really slowing, it seems like there's a good supply. But are there still accessibility issues for some people?
Absolutely. Well, I think that there are definitely a lot of places where you can get the COVID-19 vaccine now, like I was mentioning. I think we always need to keep striving to do better, to learn from our community partners about how to make this vaccine more accessible. And I'll give you an example of an area where I've been doing a lot of work, which is with community partners, is language equity. So all of the systems and structures, you know, are built for people who speak English. And so we need to be really thoughtful and intentional about how we are providing vaccines for our non-English speaking community members. And so, you know, we've done this in a couple of ways. One of my colleagues has set up a really amazing Friday clinic where there's Spanish interpreters. We've had culturally affirming community-based clinics that have been co-run or run by community-based organizations where we've had interpreters and, you know, translated documents. I think that there are definitely other opportunities to make this vaccine more accessible.
Mm-hmm. With resistance to vaccination, from your experience, does scaring people into a vaccine work? Saying things like, you can die from COVID or something like that?
That's a really interesting question. I don't think that scaring people is helpful personally. I mean, it's not really my style. I mean, I do think it's really important, though, to talk to people about what the potential ramifications are of not getting yourself or your child vaccinated. And I think, you know, that can sound really scary to people. And I don't think my intention is to ever scare somebody, because I want them to feel good about their decision. I don't want them to feel coerced. I want them to feel that they are making a decision that it's good for them. They're happy that they're getting vaccinated. They're happy they're getting their child vaccinated. Like, that's the ideal scenario, right? And so I don't want them to feel scared, but I do think it's really important. I do talk to people about what the ramifications are of not getting vaccinated.
Dr. Maya Raghavan is an assistant professor of pediatrics at Pitt School of Medicine and is the co-leader in research of the Pittsburgh Community Vaccine Collaborative. Thanks so much, doctor.
Yeah, thank you so much.
After a powerful new owner bought two affordable housing complexes in McKeesport, health code violations and 911 calls surged. Now, the residents are organizing to demand better. In a joint reporting project with Public Source, 90.5 WESA's Kate Giamarisi takes us there.
Highview Gardens is an affordable housing complex in McKeesport with more than 100 apartments. It might seem like a normal summer day here. Kids are playing outside, neighbors are talking, but there are problems inside at Highview. For years, tenants have been complaining about all kinds of issues.
I didn't have no heat all this winter.
We had bad rodent problems.
So I put a bucket here, and then when this was leaking, I had a bucket here.
You're supposed to be at comfort, at ease when you come home. You're not supposed to sleep with one eye open. You're not supposed to sleep in discomfort because you don't know what's going on with your home.
I'm pretty much here right now because I'm still looking for somewhere else to go. This is the only place I have to lay my head down.
Those are tenants Barbara Brown, Daisha Hooper, and Radia Hill. They say that things such as leaky roofs and walls, a lack of heat in the winter, problems with mail delivery, and safety concerns pushed them to organize. So in May, some residents took what they hope will be a first step in turning things around. They voted to form a tenant union with the help of a lawyer from the nonprofit Community Justice Project. Residents voted to ask management to make a number of repairs, such as installing working mailboxes, exterminating to fix issues with mice and insects, and several other changes. The president of the tenant union, Tanya Brown, has lived here for 9 years. She feels mistreated by the complex's new management.
If they could go home and have a nice heat and stuff like that and everything, I'm so comfortable at home, but they don't give a about the tenants. And it's unfair. It's unfair. There's babies in this building and stuff and everything. I got great-grandbaby. I got grandsons and stuff. My son and them come and stuff. I'm in the house bundled up cold.
Many residents say they'd like to move, but they don't think they could easily find another place to live that's affordable. Others say they stay despite the conditions because of the close bonds they have with their neighbors or other relatives who live there. The low-income apartment complex that Tanya and her neighbors live in is what's known as project-based Section 8. That means the apartments are privately owned, but the landlord receives a federal subsidy to supplement the rent tenants pay. Many tenants are either disabled or work in low-wage jobs. Residents say conditions at Highview had been getting worse since the new owner came in a few years ago. And they were shocked when WESA and Public Source told them who the owner is. Property records list Highview's owner as the generically named McKeesport Urban Holdings 2 LLC. Since 2018, that company has been controlled by PNC Bank. Here's resident Daisha Hooper again.
And if it's PNC, why ain't nothing being done?
The Pittsburgh-based bank is one of the biggest in the country and has a unit that buys affordable properties like Highview and nearby Midtown Towers, which the bank also owns. PNC says it aims to preserve these kinds of apartments and ensure their long-term affordability for residents. The bank says if they were bought by other investors, those units would be at risk of becoming market-rate housing. That could lead to tenants being displaced. Todd Crow is an executive vice president and manager of tax credit solutions for PNC Bank.
And our motivation in acquiring each of these properties was to make sure that they would remain available for the tenants that live there and that the rental assistance contract would be renewed.
He says PNC believes in the importance of affordable housing, but he was clear that the properties are an investment for the bank as well. PNC also says its long-term goal is to improve the properties using low-income housing tax credits. Crow acknowledged some of the problems residents face at Highview, though he says some issues were due to disruptions caused by the pandemic. But residents say things went downhill long before COVID.
January 2020. December 2020. Yeah, I think that's the...
Resident Tanya Brown has stacks of letters from the Allegheny County Health Department documenting complaints about conditions at Highview over the years. And there's data to back up her concerns. Health code violations from the residents of Highview and Midtown have increased since PNC took ownership. Last year, the more than 100 violations found in the complexes accounted for 42% of all the housing-related violations logged by the County Health Department in McKeesport. The complexes had only accounted for around 10% of the city's violations over the prior 3 years. And the health department isn't the only government agency tenants have turned to for help. According to public data, in the first 2 full years of PNC's control, 911 calls from Highview and Midtown jumped 46% compared to the 2 years prior. One major category of 911 calls declined: fire alarms. That may reflect another problem for residents in the complex. Jeffrey Tomasik is the fire chief for the city of McKeesport.
We've had issues with the fire alarm system having been taken offline due to malfunction, and we'll go up there and immediately test the alarm system and make sure it's working correctly, and a lot of times it hasn't been.
Building inspection records from earlier this year show the system was working correctly. The company that manages the buildings for PNC did not respond to requests for comment. Some experts say the residents' complaints about poor housing conditions are symptoms of broader problems. The Pittsburgh region's shortage of affordable units means tenants have to put up with conditions they might not tolerate otherwise. Others note that while the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development inspects properties, it doesn't often regularly contact local code enforcement officials. In the meantime, resident Tanya Brown says she'll keep pushing to make Highview a better place for the families who live there.
I'm not here just for myself. I'm here for everybody else, too. I'm not just in this for myself, you know?
Kate Giamarisi, 90.5 WESA News. This story was co-reported with Rich Lord of Public Source.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcasting app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Owen Trainer, Laura Sutsui, and Kevin Gavin. I'm Mary Lee Williams. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.